Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Sarah Stevens, and our guest this evening is Mimi Zweig. Mimi Zweig is currently professor of music at Indiana University and director of the Indiana University String Academy, which has recently received a prestigious grant from the Dorothy Starling Foundation. Ms. Zweig has been working since 1972 to develop children's string programs across the United States, and now leads master classes and pedagogy workshops around the world. Mimi is now beginning her 31st year at Indiana University. In addition to her work at IU, Mimi was director of the String Academy of Wisconsin at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, assistant principal viola of the Indianapolis Symphony, a member of the American Symphony, and the Syracuse Symphony. In honor of her work, the documentary entitled Circling Around the Violin Virtuosi was released in spring 2006 and has just been nominated for an Emmy Award. This documentary tells the story of IU String Academy students, many of whom have won numerous competitions and who teach and perform worldwide. Ms. Zweig has also recently released stringpedagogy.com, an innovative web-based teaching tool for students, teachers, and parents. Welcome, Mimi.
Thank you for inviting me here today.
Oh, I'm very excited to have you here. You've been directing the String Academy program since 1976, and it's grown from 6 students in the beginning to roughly 150 now. Could you reflect back over those 30 years and share some stories about it?
There are many stories that have evolved over the years. When I look back over all those years, sometimes it's difficult for me to even imagine how all of this happened. But when I arrived in Bloomington in 1975, I came here with my now ex-husband, Jerry Horner, who came to teach viola at Indiana University. And at first, I didn't have that much to do. I'd been teaching a little bit before in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We got to Bloomington, and I thought, what am I going to do now? So little by little, I thought, now I'm going to start teaching, but how was I going to do this? The first year, I started out of the back bedroom of our house, and I had 6 students. By the end of the third year, I think I had 30 or 35 students, and by that time was at the university. The story that leads to getting to IU, I think, is quite a moving story that I would like to tell you. It involves a wonderful woman whose name was Miriam Galvin, and she was an education professor at the university. She had always wanted to have a string program in the university, but it never quite evolved. These were the last years of Robert Klotman. So the whole string education, music education, was grinding to a halt. She asked Charles Webb, who was then dean of the music school, if he would give me a room in which to teach. And all of a sudden it happened. I had a little tiny room up in the second floor of the MAC where I began to teach. And I taught there every day, and more students were added to my class. By the end of the first year, I had so many students that I actually needed an assistant. So I went to Charles Webb, and he said, okay. And he gave me an assistant, a graduate assistant. Actually, that assistant is Rebecca Henry, who's now running the program at Peabody in Baltimore. After another year or so, it seemed that it would be a good idea to start a pedagogy class. So I went to Dean Webb and said, would you like to have a pedagogy class? And he said, yes. And I said, okay. And we started the pedagogy classes. As little by little, the class kept growing, and I began to add other assistants to the program and was training students in the pedagogy classes to teach.
So my next question was to ask you what your initial goals were for the program. Did you set out in the beginning with initial goals, or did they just evolve as you went?
That, I think, is the story of my life. If I could have known in 1976 when I began the program where I would be today, I would say that's not possible. I think I'm the kind of person that just takes each day as it comes. I'm very much living as fully as I can in the present and, of course, thinking about the future. But at that point, I didn't really have a specific goal in mind. I can tell you one thing that was significant at that time. Betty Haig came to play a concert in Bloomington with her kids from Chicago. That was the first time I had heard young people play in a group and as soloists at a level that I had never heard before. And when I heard those kids, I actually knew that that's something that I wanted to do.
That's fabulous. When you have more than done it. Now, was that the first pre-college program, the young violinist program? Because now we have the young guitarist, the young pianist, the young
the ballet,
the children's choir.
If I remember correctly, I think that the violin program was the first pre-college program and in a way set the path for the other programs to fall into place.
That's what I was wondering. It certainly has become an amazing set of programs that Indiana University has now. As you reflect back over the past 30 years, could you share some stories about the highlights of developing an internationally known program like this one? Some of the things that really stand out in your mind as being especially exciting for you and your students.
For me, every day is a highlight when I have a student that I hear makes a little progress from the week before. I am very fortunate and grateful to have the personnel with whom I collaborate in my program. For example, Brenda Brenner, my assistant, is so wonderful, and we basically are building this program together and making it what it is. Other collaborators are pianist Chi Chen and Jeanette Kukuk. And over the years, we've done a couple Beethoven violin cycles with these kids. We've done all the Mozart sonatas and Mozart concertos over the course of a few days, a couple of years ago. And when you think about it, it's amazing because these young people are between the ages of 10 and 17 and 18. Of course, when my students play with orchestra, that's always a thrill. But as I think back on all of these things, I'm convinced that the reason I'm still engaged and love my work is that I'm very happy when I can see a progress that happens from week to week with a student.
So that's a highlight that you can enjoy at every moment.
I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is a slightly different question, but it's one that I always wonder about teachers in general. As you look back at your early instruction, first of all, when did you start the violin?
I started at a relatively late age compared to the ages that we're beginning our students today. I was 8. I remember that I really wanted to play the piano, but my parents were not in a position to be able to buy a piano, but they had a friend who had an old beaten-up violin in the closet. And as I think back, I remember that that violin was a full-size violin. I was 8 years old, and I'm sure that violin was way too big for me, but we lived in a little town in California called Davis, California, which at that time had a population of 3,000 people, and it was an agricultural university school where my father was doing research. My first teacher, her name was Winnie Madison. She was not a violinist by profession. She was an artist, and I remember her as being the first gypsy lady that I ever knew, and I loved her. She would bring out little books of music that we would sight read. She was also a wonderful cook. Her daughter actually became a very, very famous chef, Deborah Madison, who opened the Greens Restaurant in San Francisco and wrote a cookbook. And I'm sure that I owe to her and, of course, to my parents who loved music and supported me the first initial introduction to the violin and music was already addictive.
Sounds like she was inspirational, even though she wasn't a professional violinist.
Yes.
That's great. But as you look back, if you could have yourself at the age of 5, what would you do with yourself differently than what was done with you?
One reason I'm sure I became a teacher, especially a teacher of children, is that those beginning lessons are of such crucial importance. In the beginning, few lessons, even month, the foundation is set or can be set for what happens later. I know for myself that in those first few lessons, my foundation was not set, and I spent many, many years trying to understand how to play the violin, how to figure out how to fly across the fingerboard, how to draw the bow, how to make a beautiful tone. I know that the intentions of my first teacher were excellent, but she simply didn't have the skills. That's why I've become very interested and committed to training teachers and to working with children to set a solid foundation in the beginning.
That makes sense. I'm wondering if having not had the solid foundation has actually made you a better teacher.
I'm sure it has.
Because you've had to think about it.
Exactly.
And people who are trained properly don't have to go through the same process. That's very interesting. I'm also curious about what some of the difficulties were when you were starting the new program. It sounds like you had a lot of support in a lot of areas, but what were some of the challenges?
In a sense, that's a difficult question. I think what I am capable of doing is taking one task at a time, or if there's an overwhelming problem, I'm capable of breaking down that problem and able to solve each problem as it arises. So with building my program in Bloomington, I can't specifically remember that there was a major difficulty to overcome. I just remember sitting in my studio many hours from day to day teaching these students. And I can attribute this journey to Charles Webb, who really laid the path for me to be able to do this. I've actually asked him, as I became a grown-up and an older person now, I said, why did you do this? How did you know I even knew what I was going to be able to do, or that I even knew what to do? And he said, and I'll never forget this, because when I deal with my faculty and different schools that I've created, I always remember his answer, which was, you hire the person and you enable them to do what they know how to do best, and they flourish.
And that is the hallmark of a great leader.
That's right.
A number of extremely well-known violinists, Joshua Bell, Sarah Caswell, Marka Gustafsson, started with you. It must be very exciting to follow their careers now. Could you reflect on your experience of being such a major part of their early musical development?
As a teacher, I see that I contribute to a portion of each person's life. If we make a timeline, I see that I can be a part of that timeline. And I'm sure that another definition of a good teacher is to allow that student then to go on and to have other influences. But when I'm working with a student at a specific time, I am involved with them, and I hopefully allow them to find their own way and to be independent. And again, we're training our students, giving them the skills with which to kick us old dinosaurs out of the way.
I hardly see you as an old dinosaur at this point. You're still having such an amazing impact on many new young players. Is there any one thing that you're proudest of?
I think, again, as we said before, it's an accumulation of all of the people that I have been able to be in the company of, my students, their parents, my teachers, my parents, my close friends, my collaborators. And I think it's conglomeration and a synthesis of all of these things that have given me the energy and the continued curiosity to keep going.
And you still work with beginners, yes?
I still, every year, run the beginner group lesson. In the String Academy, our students come twice a week for lessons in the beginning. They have a private lesson once a week, and they have a group lesson. I run the group lessons so that I can meet all of the students. Their teachers, who are generally my graduate assistants, participate in that group also so we can work together. Then at the end of the year, I say goodbye to those students, even though I see them, of course, in recitals and in our discussions with the teachers. I'm aware of their progress. And I meet up with them again when they've arrived at another level.
And then you start the next year with the next group of
That's
beginners.
That's right. That's right.
And as you said, the foundation is the most important mm-hmm. part. That's wonderful. So how many kids are in a beginning group?
We generally have 10 to 12 students in a beginning group, and they range in age from 4.5 to 6, sometimes 7. I think there's no perfect age. A lot depends on the patience of the parent, because the parents come to all the lessons and commit to practicing at home every day with their child. So it really is a very interesting collaboration and triangle, I call it, of the parent, the student, and the teacher. And that circle has to keep working in order for the student to progress.
That leads me to ask, because it's very similar to what Suzuki says in Nurtured by Love, that triangle. Can you tell me a little bit about how your approach may be similar to Suzuki's and how it may be different?
Suzuki was a big influence on my life, even though I only saw him once.
You've actually met him?
Yes.
How old were you when you met him?
I can't exactly remember, but maybe it was 20 years ago. And this man lived a very, very long life. So when I met him, he was already quite old. But I can say that my teaching is a combination of Suzuki, Paul Rolin, and of my own teachers and my own experiences. So I think from Suzuki, what is very important that I use in my teaching is his philosophy that every child can reach his or her potential given the correct environment. We try to figure out what the ideal environment is, and that would be listening to good music, a supportive parent, curiosity in the education, and the ability to practice, etc. So we try to create that environment. Also, his concept of the students learning in the private lesson situation and in the group class. That is an ideal situation for young kids. If you're just in a private lesson, you're so alone, and you don't have a clue of what's happening with all your friends out there. But if you have that private lesson where you learn at your pace and your speed, you put yourself in a group with other children of the same age or the same ability, same level of playing, it's amazing what happens. Those kids are looking at each other and wanting to be as good, if not better, than their friends. Plus, it's a community that they grow up with.
That's fabulous. And so that's what you've taken from Suzuki.
Suzuki.
Now, you mentioned Paul Rolin, too. I don't know anything about Paul Rolin. Could you tell me who he is?
He was a very, very important man in the pedagogy of the last part of the 20th century. He was a professor who taught at University of Illinois in Champaign. The story goes that he saw children playing in the public school, and he was totally distraught at what he saw. And he thought, I think that there's a better way to be able to teach these kids. So he got a grant, and he spent a couple years devising an approach to teach kids actually in the public school. His whole concept of violin playing was based on the natural physical approach of playing, which is the basis of what I do in my teaching. He also came up with very innovative technical things to do that in the very beginning stages, the kids are shifting, the vibrato impulse is released.
In the very beginning stages, how soon do you mean?
Like the first lesson.
They're shifting?
Yes. For example, if you remember, we had our little lesson
last
week.
To say to the listening audience, uh-huh. Mimi gave me my first violin lesson with Mimi, something I've wanted to have since 1976.
You could have been in my first class.
Yes. And I learned many things, but I'm giving the listeners context for what mm-hmm. you're about to say.
So in that first lesson, you were sliding up and down on the fingerboard on your Magic X. So that already set up the shifting impulse. And then you were tapping on the left side of the violin. That is the release of the vibrato impulse.
I see.
So it's really amazing what this man did in these beginning stages, how he could set the stage for all of the quote-unquote difficulties of playing the violin.
That's fabulous. Mm-hmm. So did you mention another name? Or
Then there were the influences, of course, of my teachers. I studied with Louis Krasner for 4 years in Syracuse. I studied with Raphael Bronstein at the Manhattan School of Music for a year. I was very influenced by a teacher whose name is Samuel Kissel, who was a student of Dunas. And Dunas was a very specific teacher or special teacher that people would go to after they had already attained careers. They would go to him for 4 or 5 hour lessons once every month. And so this man, when I went to Sam Kissel, he was the teacher that I needed at that time because he could answer so many questions that I had. I also owe a lot to my ex-husband, Jerry Horner, who helped me through many basic principles. And then I should say that I'm probably not very original. I'm like a giant sponge. When we got to Bloomington, I had the privilege of spending 1 week in Janos Starker's master classes. And I'll never forget those classes because in every class he addressed a specific topic. And again, I was at the point where I was needing this information and I was ready to absorb it. And then after that, of course, I was under the influence of Joseph Gingold, who I credit as being my mentor.
What an incredible group of people.
I'm fortunate.
Yes. And you are an incredible person, too. You reflect all that you have absorbed as a sponge. Now, I would like you to take us into your studio with a beginning violin student, the first lesson, just as you gave me. Mm-hmm. Let's say I'm 5 years old and I'm walking out of the room after my first lesson. What's the most important thing I've learned?
Again, this first lesson is so interesting because it set the foundation for so many things to come. The first thing you have learned is how to stand, the relationship of the body to the violin. You've learned the placement of the violin. You've learned the rudiments of shifting, the rudiments of vibrato. You have also learned a piece of repertoire, one entire piece of repertoire that is setting the shape of the left hand. And on top of that, you've also learned how to practice because when you go home, your parent has been given instructions that they will practice with you. And again, practicing can be spelled out specifically. You can't turn an egg timer over for a child and expect them to practice half an hour because they don't know what to do. So we need to be specific. So we say you practice your Statue of Liberty 10 times a day. You practice your piece of repertoire 15 times a day. You practice putting your feet together, making a V 10 times a day, et cetera, et cetera. So by the time this child gets to the level of playing Vivaldi concerto, Haydn concertos, Paganini caprices, they already know how to isolate and separate tasks, and they know that by repeating them and through repetition, they will be able to accomplish what needs to be done.
Fantastic. Now, I know you've brought some music for us to listen to today. Could mm-hmm. you tell us what your first piece is, what we're listening to next?
The first piece that I brought with me is a performance that was made by a group called the Violin Virtuosi. This is the top group or the most advanced group of the students in the Indiana University String Academy. This is a group that goes on tour. They've been to France a couple times, in Spain, Sweden, Italy, Japan. And they're a wonderful, wonderful bunch of young people. They play pieces together in their concerts, and then they each play as a soloist. The piece that I brought for us today is a piece by Edward Elgar called La Capricieuse, and they're playing as a group, and Chi Chen is the pianist.
We've just been listening to La Capricieuse by Edward Elgar, performed by the violin virtuosi. You're listening to Profiles. I'm your host, Sarah Stevens, and my guest today is Mimi Zweig. Mimi, you must be very excited. You have just produced a film entitled Circling Around. And it came out in the spring of 2006, and it's just been nominated for an Emmy. Could you tell our audience what Circling Around is?
It has been very exciting. Circling Around the Violin Virtuosi is a documentary that was made by PBS. It is a story told by members of the Violin Virtuosi group, which is the group we just heard playing La Capricieuse. It is footage that has been filmed on many of our tours in France, Japan, Bloomington, Chicago. It is a story told by these young people of what it takes to become a violinist, what sacrifices they make, what they gain from it, how it's changed their lives, how they view their future with it, how the violin has become something special, very, very special in their lives. And in some instances, with one of the students in this film, how she actually decided not to become a violinist and is actually now at University of Chicago majoring in psychology.
That sounds fascinating. Could you tell me a little bit about the making of this film, how it came about?
That is interesting. This film was a joint collaboration between WTIU, RIAX with Hideki Isoda, and the Jacobs School of Music. It came about that Hideki, who is the husband of Chi Chen, our pianist, came on tour with us over the course of many years, over the course actually of 4 years. We were in France and in Spain and in Italy and Japan and Chicago and Bloomington, et cetera, et cetera. By the time we sat down one day to talk about all of this film footage, we had 100 hours of film. We didn't know exactly what to do with it. And then Carrie Boyce came in. And Carrie, who's working now for you at WFIU, he said, I have the perfect person with whom you should speak about all of this film footage. And that was Steve Kroenke, who became our executive producer at WTIU. Steve took a look at the footage, and he loved it right away. And he believed in us. He believed in Hideki. So what came out a year later is this documentary. The purpose for me with this documentary was to have it be an inspiration to young people that are playing the violin. They can see what's possible. To parents who may have questions about why are we playing the violin? What is this all about? And to teachers throughout the country or the world, that they can see what young people are capable of accomplishing.
Fantastic. Now, what was your role in making the film? Did you actually work on the making of the film yourself, or did Hideki do most of that?
Hideki made the film. We had many meetings together. I had many meetings with Hideki, and the three of us, Steve Kroenke, myself, and Hideki, would meet every 2 weeks, every month, and we would come with a different cut of the film. We would discuss the form of the film. We would create the storyline, but Hideki and Steve get the credit for putting this film together. By the way, the film is not about me. It's about the students and what it takes for them to attain a certain level of excellence.
How do we see this movie? How can our listening audience get a copy of it?
It is being shown on over 220 public television stations throughout the country. It's also available from Marketplace at Indiana University, and it's a DVD. It can be purchased as a DVD. On the DVD, there are extra interviews with Steve Kroenke, Hideki, and myself. There's a Vivi performance and a few other little extra things.
By Vivi, you mean?
Violin virtuosi.
Yes. That sounds fantastic. Well, I'm sure that a lot of people will be interested in seeing that because it will inform, I would think it would be very informative to parents who are looking at early musical instruction for their children.
Yes, yes, for sure.
You've done something else recently besides put out a film. You've set up a website and created an instructional DVD, stringpedagogy.com. Could you explain what that is, too?
Again, I have to give a lot of credit to Hideki Isoda. We were sitting around having dinner. As you can tell, we're eating quite often. And Hideki said, "You have all of these great ideas about teaching. Why don't you write something? Why don't we do something on the web?" And I remembered that my father had always said, "Why don't you write a book?" He had written a bunch of scientific books and journals, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, "I'm not ready to write a book. I don't know anything yet. I don't know enough yet." Hideki said, "Yeah, just try to put something down." And at the same time, I had the opportunity to meet a very wonderful woman, Peggy Wheeler, who actually became my co-author. She got very excited about this whole project, and she's such an articulate, intellectual person that she could help us organize the ideas. So again, I sat with Hideki for many hours, and what I found so incredible is we would start with a blank page, a blank computer screen, and within minutes, the screen was filled with the organization of a website. And I think this website, the engineering of this website is incredible. It's so easy to navigate. It is amazing what can be put on a DVD now. And as we speak, technology is always moving faster, that we're revising things and simplifying things. But the information is presented in such a way that could never be presented in a book because we can link to infinite places.
Yes. Now, who is the intended audience for this?
The main purpose of starting this project was that I sit on auditions for the IU School of Music, of course, every year. And every year we hear many wonderful students, but we also hear students who are very gifted but who have not had good training at first. And I sit and I listen and I think, if these kids had had access, or their teachers had had access to information that could help them, they would then have the opportunity to have a choice with what they want to do with their life. I think that was my inspiration to put this information down. So it's geared, yes, towards teachers, and then towards students and towards parents.
Toward both private teachers and public school teachers?
All teachers, public school, private studio teachers, university studios, also pedagogy classes. I use this material in our pedagogy classes here at IU.
It must be wonderful as you teach the pedagogy classes to have access to all of this.
Well, no. I'll tell you, it makes it a lot easier because if I can't get through all of my points, I just say, take a look at the website.
Fantastic. Well, you've brought another piece of music for us today. Could you tell us a little bit about
this?
Yes,
I would be happy to. I brought a Kreisler piece performed by Joseph Gingold, and I brought this because Mr. Gingold, as we all called him, was my mentor. Even today, when I'm teaching, I hear him in my ear saying, try this fingering, try this way to turn the phrase, try this quality of sound here. So he's very close to my heart, as he is to many people throughout the world. So we have here his rendition of Slavonic Fantasy by Kreisler, originally by Dvorak.
You've just been listening to Slavonic Fantasy by Anton Dvorak, arranged by Fritz Kreisler, and performed by Joseph Gingold, violin, and Charles Webb, piano. You're listening to Profiles. I'm your host, Sarah Stevens, and my guest this evening is Mimi Zweig. We were just talking about, Mimi, about your two projects circling around the video and your website. Could you tell our listening audience how they can access both of those on the web?
I would love to do that. Circling Around is www.circlingaround.com. And String Pedagogy is, again, www. That's a little difficult to say. stringpedagogy.com.
Wonderful. So if anyone wants to go online, these are all available for anyone to look at. In this last portion, I'd like to talk a little bit about music education in general. Other than the pure value of learning music, could you tell parents what you feel are the most important side benefits of early musical training?
I am such an advocate for early musical training for kids, and we can just look around us and see that these children who are studying the violin or the piano or singing, dancing, that these young people seem to be more focused, have a high self-esteem. They've learned skills that can help them concentrate on all subjects that they will encounter in their education. I think playing the violin specifically, because it is a difficult instrument. It takes a lot of patience. It takes time to master it. If these skills that are mastered in learning how to play the violin can be applied to other subjects, success is guaranteed. I find it fascinating in today's world. Things are so accessible. These kids now that are growing up, they grow up with computers. They grow up with 500 stations on the television. They now grow up with iPods where you can put 700 hours of music on these things. You have instant gratification. When they pick up the violin, instant gratification is a non-existent entity. It takes 10 years to even be a mediocre violinist, let alone a great violinist. So hard to know, and this is kind of a cliche, that are students more gifted because they play the violin? Or are the gifted students attracted to the violin? And I think all of these things are connected.
Do you have any musical advice for the parents of very young children?
I would say that you ask your child what instrument appeals to them, because all of us have an inner voice that can be expressed through another instrument or through movement. So all of us children will naturally gravitate towards an instrument that will speak for them. Some children will choose the violin or the cello or a wind instrument. Again, how does a child know if they've never heard these instruments? So yes, I think music should be part of a child's life. Classical music, other kinds of music too. Taking children to concerts, yes. Keeping them exposed so that then they will have the opportunity and the understanding to be able to choose an instrument.
And could you give some advice to school teachers and school administrators?
Music is such an important part of a child's upbringing. I say this often, if our leaders, if our political leaders had studied the violin or the piano for 15 or 20 years before they became political scientists, maybe they would make better, wiser, patient decisions, because it's an understanding of a culture, and art and music and culture is our history. I think the Starling Foundation, which has supported my work now for 4 years, understands the importance of training violinists from the earliest age. I think many times educators don't understand that the basic training that we give young people is crucial to how they're going to be later on. And I see so many times prep schools or children's schools or little music schools are not given the credit or the support that is so important. And for that, I am so grateful that Starling could come forward with a substantial amount of money and say, yes, this is something that is very crucial to the training of our next generation of musicians.
That is absolutely wonderful. Could you philosophically reflect on life?
I see my life as an integration of music and education, and all of this continuing to keep a curiosity that nothing ever remains the same for very long.
Ooh, that connects really well to the title of your film, Circling Around.
Yes, and Circling Around, we're always circling around, beginning again.
Wonderful. And you connected that with the title of the film to the movement of the bow, too.
Exactly.
And so the violin is a metaphor for everything.
Exactly.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I have to give credit to the title to my life partner, Attar Rad. He's the one that came up with that title.
That's a wonderful title. Mm-hmm. I love it. That's absolutely fabulous. Now, speaking of Attar Rad, you have a final piece of music to share with us today?
Yes, Attar's daughter, Galia, has opened my world to a different kind of music. I see myself as a little bit classical nerd probably for the last 55 years or so, but she has totally opened my world to her kind of music, and she's a songwriter and a singer, and I brought one of her songs with me. She's playing it and singing it, and it's called Sand in Your Bed.
You've been listening to Profiles, and I've been talking to Mimi Zweig. Thank you, Mimi, so much for being here.
Thank you, Sarah.
Could you tell our listening audience one last time? I know you did it before, but people turn the radio on and off. The web addresses for your two most recent projects.
www.circlingaround.com, www.stringpedagogy.com.
Thank you so much, Mimi Zweig. You've been listening to Profiles, and I'm your host, Sarah Stevens.
It's time for you to go, he said. You got your sand all over my bed. I really hate asking you to leave, but you messed up everything I had cleaned. I'm sorry, I said, I won't do it again. Is there anything I can do to keep me here laying next to you?
I'll be more. The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in June of 2006. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blackland McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.